admitted. Owls being larger than bosuns or barnacles, with 200 species and wide folkloric resonance, mostly of ill omen. Unlike Trudy, with her visceral certainties, I quiver with doubts. Either my father, being neither sap nor saint, has come to present his lover, put my mother in her place, which is in his past, and show indifference to his brother's infamy, or he's even more the sap, too much the saint, dropping in chastely with one of his authors as a form of social protection, in hopes of being in Trudy's presence for as long as she'll tolerate him. Or something beyond both, too opaque to determine. Simpler, for now at least, to follow my mother's lead and assume that this friend is my father's mistress. No child, still less a fetus, has ever mastered the art of small talk, or would ever want to. It's an adult device, a covenant with boredom and deceit. In this case, mostly the latter. After a tentative scrape of chairs, the offer of wine, the pull of a cork, a comment from Claude about the heat draws my father's neutral hum of assent. A fitful exchange between the brothers projects the lie that our visitors happen to be passing. Trudy remains silent, even when the poet is introduced as Elodie. No one comments on the elegant social geometry of a married couple and their lovers around a table, raising a glass, a tableau vivant of brittle modern life. My father appears unfazed to find his brother in his kitchen, opening the wine, playing the host. Sir John Cairncross was never the dupe, the unknowing cuckold. My underestimated father blandly sips and asks Trudy how she's feeling. Not too tired, he hopes, which may or may not be a gentle dig, a sexual allusion. That plaintive tone of his has vanished. Distance or irony has replaced it. Only satisfied desire could have freed him. Trudy and Claude must wonder why their murderee is here, what he wants, but it wouldn't be right to ask. Instead, Claude asks Elodie if she lives nearby. No, she doesn't. She lives in Devon, in a studio, on a farm, near a river, by which she might be letting Trudy know that here in London she'll be overnighting between John's Shoreditch sheets. She's staking a claim. I like the sound of her voice, the human approximation, I would say, of the oboe, slightly cracked, with a quack on the vowels. And towards the end of her phrases, she speaks through a gargling, growling sound that American linguists have dubbed vocal fry. Spreading through the Western world, much discussed on the radio, of unknown etiology, signifying, it's thought, sophistication, found mostly in young, educated women. A pleasing puzzle. With such a voice, she might hold her own against my mother. Nothing in my father's manner suggests that only this afternoon his brother fronted him £5,000 in cash. No gratitude, same old fraternal contempt. That must stir Claude's ancient hatred. And in me, something more hypothetical, a potential grudge. Even as I cast my father as a lovelorn fool, I always assumed that if matters became intolerable with Claude, and if I failed to unite my parents, I might live with my father, at least for a while, until I got on my feet. But I don't think this poet would take me on. Tight black jeans and leather jacket is not maternity wear. That's part of her allure. In my narrow view, my father would be better single. Pale beauty and an assured duck's voice are not my allies. But there may be nothing between them, and I like her. Claude has just said, "A studio? On a farm? How marvellous." Elodie is describing in her urban growl an A-frame cabin on the banks of a dark and rushing river that foams round granite boulders, a dodgy footbridge to the other side, a copse of beeches and birch, a bright clearing spangled with anemones and celandines, bluebells and spurge. "Perfect for a nature poet," Claude says. So true and dull is this that Elodie falters. He presses in. "How far is it all from London?" By all, he refers to the pointless river and rocks and trees and flowers. Deflated, she can barely fry her words. "About 200 miles. She's guessed that he'll ask her about the nearest railway station and how long the journey takes, information he'll soon forget. But he asks, she answers, and we three listen, not stupefied or even mildly bored. Each of us, from each different point of view, is gripped by what's not being said. The lovers, if Elodie is one, the two parties external to the marriage, are the dual charge that will blast this household apart, and blow me upwards, hellwards, to my 13th floor. In a gentle tone of rescue, John Cairncross mentions that he likes the wine, a prompt to Claude to refill the glasses. While he obliges, there settles over us a silence. I conjure a taut piano wire, waiting for its sudden felt hammer. Trudy is about to speak. I know from the syncopated trip of her heartbeat, just before her first word. These owls, are they real, or do they, like, stand for something?
No, Elodie says in a rush. They're real. I write from life. But the reader, you know, imports the symbols, the associations. I can't keep them out. That's how poetry works.
I always think of owls, says Claude, as wise. The poet pauses, tasting the air for sarcasm. She's getting his measure and says evenly,
There you are then. Nothing I can do about that.
Owls are vicious, Trudy says. Elodie.
Like robins are. Like nature is.
Trudy. Inedible, apparently. Elodie.
And the broody owl's poisonous.
Trudy. Yes. The broody one can kill you.
Elodie. I don't think so. She just makes you sick.
Trudy. I mean, if she gets her claws into your face.
Elodie. Never happens. She's too shy.
Trudy. Not when provoked. The exchange is relaxed, the tone inconsequential. Small talk, or a trade in threat and insult. I lack the social experience to know. If I'm drunk, then Trudy must be too, but there's nothing in her manner to suggest it. Loathing for Elodie, now framed as a rival, may be an elixir of sobriety. John Cairncross seems content to pass his wife on to Claude Cairncross. This puts the steel in my mother, who believes the discarding and passing on is hers to decide. She may deny my father Elodie, she may deny him life itself, but I may be wrong. My father reciting in the library, appearing to prize every second in my mother's presence, allowing her to shove him into the street. Just go! I can't trust my judgment. Nothing fits. But no time to think now. He's on his feet, looming over us, wine in hand, swaying barely at all, ready to make a speech. Quiet, everyone. Trudy, Claude, Elodie, I might be brief. I might not. Who cares? I want to say this. When love dies, and a marriage lies in ruins, the first casualty is honest memory, decent, impartial recall of the past. Too inconvenient, too damning of the present. It's the spectre of old happiness at the feast of failure and desolation. So, against that headwind of forgetfulness, I want to place my little candle of truth and see how far it throws its light. Almost 10 years ago, on the Dalmatian coast, in a cheap hotel without sight of the Adriatic, in a room an eighth the size of this, in a bed barely 3 feet across, Trudy and I tumbled into love, into ecstasy and trust, joy and peace without horizon, without time, beyond words. We turned our backs on the world to invent and build our own. We thrilled each other with pretended violence, and we cosseted and babied each other too, gave each other nicknames, had a private language. We were beyond embarrassment. We gave and received and permitted everything. We were heroic. We believed we stood on a summit no one else, not in life, not in all poetry, had ever climbed.
Our love was so fine and grand, it seemed to us a universal principle. It was a system of ethics, a means of relating to others that was so fundamental that the world had overlooked it somehow. When we lay on the narrow bed face to face, looked deep into each other's eyes and talked, we brought ourselves into being. She took my hands and kissed them, and for the first time in my life, I wasn't ashamed of them. Our families, which we described to each other in detail, at last made sense to us. We loved them urgently, despite all the difficulties of the past. Same with our best, most important friends. We could redeem everyone we knew. Our love was for the good of the world. Trudy and I had never talked or listened with such attention. Our lovemaking was an extension of our talking of our lovemaking. When that week was over and we came back and set up together here in my house, the love went on, months, then years. It seemed that nothing could ever get in its way. So before I go any further, I'm raising my glass to that love. May it never be denied, forgotten, distorted, or rejected as illusion. To our love. It happened. It was true. I hear a shuffle and murmur of reluctant accord, and closer by, I hear my mother swallow hard before she pretends to drink the toast. I think she's taken against my house. Now, my father continues, lowering his voice as though entering a funeral parlour, that love has run its course. It never collapsed into mere routine or a hedge against old age. It died quickly, tragically, as love on a grand scale must. The curtains come down. It's over. And I'm glad. Trudy's glad. Everyone who knows us is glad and relieved. We trusted each other. Now we don't. We loved each other. Now I detest her as much as she detests me. Trudy, my sweet, I can hardly stand the sight of you. There have been times when I could have strangled you. I've had dreams, happy dreams, in which I see my thumbs tightening against your carotid arteries. I know you feel the same about me. But that's no cause for regret. Let's rejoice instead. These are just the dark feelings we need to set ourselves free. To be reborn into new life and new love. Elodie and I have found that love, and we are bound by it for the rest of our lives. Wait, Elodie says. I think she fears my father's taste for indiscretion. But he won't take an interruption. Trudy and Claude, I'm happy for you. You came together at the perfect moment. No one will deny it. You truly deserve each other. This is a curse, though my father sounds impenetrably sincere. To be tied to a man as vapid but sexually vigorous as Claude is a complex fate. His brother knows it. But shush, he's still talking. There are arrangements to make. There'll be arguments and stress, but the overall scheme is simple, and for that we're blessed. Claude, you have your nice big place in Primrose Hill, and Trudy, you can move there. I'll be moving some stuff back in here tomorrow. As soon as you've gone, and the decorators have done their work, Elodie will move in with me. I suggest we don't see each other for a year or so, and then think again. The divorce should be straightforward. The important thing to remember, at all times, is to be rational and civil, and to remember how lucky we are to have found love again. Okay? Good. No, no, don't get up. We'll see ourselves out. Trudy, if you're here, I'll see you tomorrow around 10. I won't stay long. Gotta get straight up to St. Albans. And by the way, I found my key. There's the sound of a chair as Elodie stands. May I say something now? My father is genial and firm. Not remotely appropriate. But, come on, time to go. Thanks for the wine. A moment of throat clearing, then their footsteps recede across the kitchen and up the stairs. My mother and her lover sit in silence, as we listen to them go. We hear the front door close upstairs with a punctuating final sound, a full stop. Trudy and Claude are stunned. I'm in turmoil. What was I in my father's peroration? Dead. Head first in a burial mound within his hated ex-wife's gut. Not even a mention. Not in an aside, not even dismissed as an irrelevance. A year or so must pass before my saviour sees me. He paid tribute to honest memory, and he forgot me. In a rush towards his own rebirth, he discarded mine. Fathers and sons. I heard it once and won't forget. What links them in nature? An instant of blind rut. Try this. He moved to Shoreditch to sample a tryst with Elodie. He vacated the terrace so Claude could move in and give John good cause to throw Trudy out. The anxious visits, the earnest poetry, even the lost key were feints, lulling her into greater security with Claude, drawing them together. Claude is pouring more wine. In the circumstances it's a comfort, how he reaches with dull precision for his most vacuous thought. Fancy that. Trudy doesn't speak for half a minute. When she does, her words are slurred, but her resolve is clear.
I want him dead. And it has to be tomorrow.
8. Outside these warm, living walls, an icy tale slides towards its hideous conclusion. The midsummer clouds are thick, there's no moon, not the faintest breeze. But my mother and uncle are talking up a winter storm. The cork is drawn from one more bottle, then, too soon, another. I'm washed far downstream of drunkenness, my senses blur their words, but I hear in them the form of my ruin. Shadow figures on a bloody screen are arguing in hopeless struggle with their fate. The voices rise and fall. When they don't accuse or wrangle, they conspire. What's said hangs in the air like a Beijing smog. It will end badly, and the house feels the ruin too. In high summer, the February gale twists and breaks the icicles hanging from the gutters, scours the unpointed brickwork of the gable ends, rips the slates, those blank slates, from the pitching roofs. This chill works its fingers past the rotted putty of the unwashed panes. It backs up through the kitchen drains. I'm shivering in here. But it won't end. The bad will be endless, until ending badly will seem a blessing. Nothing will be forgotten, nothing flushed away. Foul matter lingers in unseen bends beyond the plumber's reach. It hangs in the wardrobes with Trudy's winter coats. This too solid stench feeds the timid mice behind the skirting and swells them to rats. We hear their gnawing and mutinous curses, but no one is surprised. At intervals, my mother and I retire, so she may squat and copiously piss and groan. Against my skull, I feel her bladder shrink, and I'm relieved. Back to the table, to more scheming and long harangues. It was my uncle cursing, not the rats. That gnawing was my mother of the salted nuts. Incessantly, she eats for me. In here, I dream of my entitlement, security. Weightless peace, no tasks, no crime or guilt. I'm thinking about what should have been mine in my confinement. Two opposing notions haunt me. I heard about them in a podcast my mother left running while talking on the phone. We were on the couch in my father's library, windows wide open to another sultry midday. Boredom, said this Monsieur Bart, is not far from bliss. One regards boredom from the shores of pleasure. Exactly so. The condition of the modern fetus. Just think, nothing to do but be and grow, where growing is hardly a conscious act. The joy of pure existence, the tedium of undifferentiated days. Extended bliss is boredom of the existential kind. This confinement shouldn't be a prison. In here I'm owed the privilege and luxury of solitude. I speak as an innocent, but I conjure an orgasm prolonged into eternity. There's boredom for you, in the realm of the sublime. This was my patrimony, until my mother wished my father dead. Now I live inside a story, and fret about its outcome. Where's boredom or bliss in that? My uncle rises from the kitchen table, lurches towards the wall to turn off the lights and reveal the dawn. If he'd been my father, he might have recited No Bard, but now there's only a practical concern. It's time for bed. What deliverance that they're too drunk for sex. Trudy stands. Together we sway. If I could be upright for 1 minute, I'd feel less sick. How I miss my spacious days of ocean tumbling. With 1 foot on the first tread, she halts to gauge the climb ahead. It rises severely and recedes as though to the moon. I feel her grip the banister on my account. I still love her, I'd like her to know. But if she falls backwards, I die. Now we're going mostly up. Mostly, Claude is ahead of us. We should be roped. Grip tighter, mother. It's an effort, and no one speaks. After many minutes, many sighs and moans, we gain the second floor landing, and the rest, the last 12 feet, though level, is also tough. She sits on her side of the bed to remove a sandal, topples sideways with it in her hand, and falls asleep. Claude shakes her awake. Together they fumble in the bathroom, through the spilling drawers, in search of 2 grams each of paracetamol, a means to hold a hangover at bay. Claude notes, "Tomorrow's a busy day." He means today. My father is due at 10, now it's almost 6. Finally, we're all in bed. My mother complains that the world, her world, spins when she closes her eyes. I thought Claude might be more stoical, made, as he might say, of sterner stuff. Not so. Within minutes, he's hurried next door to fall to his knees and embrace the lavatory bowl.
"Lift the seat!"
Trudy shouts. Silence. Then it comes, in hard-won dribbles. But he's loud. A long shout truncated, as though a football fan has been stabbed in the back mid-chant. By 7, they're asleep. Not me. My thoughts turn with my mother's world. My father's rejection of me. His possible fate. My responsibility for it. Then my own fate. My inability to warn or act. And my bedfellows. Too damaged to make the attempt? Or worse, to do it badly, be caught and sent down? Hence the spectral prison that's lately haunted me. To start life in a cell, bliss unknown, boredom a fought-for privilege. And if they succeed, then it's the veil of SWAT. I see no scheme, no plausible route to any conceivable happiness. I wish never to be born. I overslept. I'm woken by a shout and a violent arrhythmic jigging. My mother on the wall of death. Not so. Or not that one. This is her descending the stairs too fast, her careless hand barely trailing the banister. Here's how it could end. The loose carpet rod, or curling threadbare carpet edge, the headfirst downward pitch, then my private gloom lost to eternal darkness. I've nothing to hold on to but hope. The shout was from my uncle. He calls out again.
"I've been out for the drink. We've got 20 minutes. Make the coffee. I'll do the rest."
His dim Shoreditch plans have been ditched by my mother's lust for speed. John Cairncross is not her fool after all. He'll kick her out, and soon. She must act today. No time to tend her plaits. She's given hospitality to her husband's lover. Dumped before she could dump, as they say on the afternoon agony aunt shows. Teenagers phone in with problems that would stump a Plato or a Kant. Trudy's anger is oceanic, vast and deep. It's her medium, her selfhood. I know it in her altered blood as it washes through me, in the granular discomfort where cells are bothered and compressed, the platelets cracked and chipped. My heart is struggling with my mother's angry blood.
We're safely on the ground floor, among the busy morning hum of flies that cruise the hallway's garbage. To them, the untied plastic bags rise like shining residential towers with rooftop gardens. The flies go there to graze and vomit at their ease. Their general bloated laziness invokes a society of mellow recreation, communal purpose, mutual tolerance. This somnolent, non-chordate crew is at one with the world. It loves rich life in all its putrefaction, whereas we're a lower form, fearful and in constant discord. We've got the jitters. We're going too fast. Trudy's trailing hand grips the newel post, and we swing through a speedy U-turn. 10 steps, and we're at the head of the kitchen stairs. No handrail to guide us down. It fell off the wall, I heard, in a burst of dust and horsehair, before my time, if this is my time. Only irregular holes remain. The treads are bare pine, with slick and greasy knots, palimpsests of forgotten spills, downtrodden meat and fat, and molten butter sliding off the toast my father used to carry to the library without a plate. Again, she's going at speed, and this could be it, the headlong launch. Hardly has the thought illuminated my fears when I sense a backwards sliding foot, a forward lurch, an urge to flight, countered at once by a panicky tightening of the muscles in her lower back, and from behind my shoulder I hear a wrenching sound of tendons stretching and testing their anchors on the bone. "My back!" she growls. "My fucking back!" But it's worth her pain, for she steadied herself and takes the remaining steps with care. Claude, busy by the kitchen sink, pauses to make a sympathetic sound, then continues with his tasks. Time waits for no man, as he might say. She's at his side. "My head," she whispers. "And mine." Then he shows her. I think it's his favourite. Bananas, pineapple, apple, mint, wheat germ.
"Tropical dawn."
"Yep. And here's the business. Enough to fell 10 ox.
"Oxen."
He pours the 2 liquids into the blender and activates it. "When the dinner's ceased," she says,
"put it in the fridge. I'll make the coffee. Hide those paper cups. Don't touch them without your gloves."
We're at the coffee machine. She's found the filters. She's spooning in the grains, tipping in the water. Doing well. "Wash some mugs," she calls. "And set them out. Get the stuff ready for the car. John's gloves are in the outhouse. They'll need dusting down. And there's a plastic bag somewhere." "All right, all right." Out of bed long before her, Claude sounds testy as she takes control. I struggle to follow their exchange.
"My thing and the bank statement are on the table."
"I know.
Don't forget the receipt."
"I won't."
"Screw it up a bit."
"I have."
"With your gloves, not his."
"Yes."
"You wore the hat in Judd Street."
"Of course."
"Put it where he'll see it."
"I have." But he's at the sink, rinsing crusty cups, doing as he's told. She's impervious to his tone and adds,
"We should tidy this place up."
He grunts. A hopeless notion. Good wife Trudy wants to greet her husband with a tidy kitchen. But surely none of this can work. Elodie knows that my father is expected here. Perhaps 6 friends know too. London, north to east, will point a finger across the corpse. Here's a pretty folie à deux. Could my mother, who's never had a job, launch herself as a murderer? A tough profession, not only in the planning and execution, but in the aftermath, when the career would properly begin. Consider, I want to say to her, even before the ethics, the inconvenience. Imprisonment, or guilt, or both, extended hours, weekends too, and all through every night, for life. No pay, no perks, no pension, but remorse. She's making a mistake. But the lovers are locked in, as only lovers can be. Being busy about the kitchen keeps them steady. They clear from the table last night's debris, sweep up or sweep aside food scraps on the floor, then down more painkillers with a slug of coffee. That's all the breakfast I'm getting. They agree that around the kitchen sink, there's nothing to be done. My mother mutters instructions or guidelines. Claude remains terse. Each time he cuts her off. He may be having second thoughts. Cheerful, okay? Like we thought through what he said last night and decided,
right?
After minutes of silence. Don't go offering too soon. We need...
I won't.
And again. Two empty glasses to show that we've had some ourselves already, and the Smoothie Heaven cup...
It's done. They're behind you.
On his final word, we're startled by my father's voice from the top of the kitchen stairs. Of course, he has his key. He's in the house. He calls down.
Just unloading the car, then I'll be with you.
His tone is gruff, competent. Unearthly love has made him worldly. Claude whispers. What if he locks it? I'm close to my mother's heart and know its rhythms and sudden turns. And now it accelerates at her husband's voice, and there's an added sound, a disturbance in the chambers, like the distant rattling of maracas or gravel shuffled softly in a tin. From down here, I'd say it's a semi-lunar valve whose cusps are snapping shut too hard and sticking, or it could be her teeth. But to the world, my mother appears serene. She remains the liege and mistress of her voice, which is even and doesn't stoop to whispers. He's a poet. He never locks the car. When I give you the sign, go out there with the stuff. 9. Dear Father, before you die, I'd like a word. We haven't much time, far less than you think, so forgive me for coming to the point. I need to tap your memory. There was a morning in your library, a Sunday of unusual summer rain, when the air, for once, was clean of dust. The windows were open. We heard the pattering on the leaves. You and my mother almost resembled a happy couple. There was a poem you recited then, too good for one of yours, I think you'd be the first to concede. Short, dense, bitter to the point of resignation, difficult to understand. The sort that hits you, hurts you, before you followed exactly what was said. It addressed a careless, indifferent reader, a lost lover, a real person, I should think. In 14 lines, it talked of hopeless attachment, wretched preoccupation, longing unresolved and unacknowledged. It summoned a rival, mighty in talent or social rank or both, and it bowed in self-effacement. Eventually, time would have its revenge, but no one would care or even remember, unless they chanced to read these lines. The person the poem addressed I think of as the world I'm about to meet. Already I love it too hard. I don't know what it will make of me, whether it will care for me or even notice me. From here it seems unkind, careless of life, of lives. The news is brutal, unreal. A nightmare we can't wake from. I listen with my mother, rapt and glum. Enslaved teenage girls, preyed over then raped. Barrels used as bombs over cities. Children used as bombs in marketplaces. We heard from Austria about a locked roadside truck and 71 migrants left to panic, suffocate and rot. Only the brave would send their imaginations inside the final moments. These are new times. Perhaps they're ancient. But also, that poem makes me think of you and your speech last night, and how you won't or can't return my love. From where I am, you and my mother and the world are all one. Hyperbole, I know. The world is also full of wonders, which is why I'm foolishly in love with it. And I love and admire you both. What I'm saying is, I'm fearful of rejection. So say it again to me, this poem, with your dying breath, and I'll say it back to you. Let it be the last thing you ever hear. Then you'll know what I mean. Or take the kinder course, live rather than die, accept your son, hold me in your arms, claim me for your own.
In return, I'll give you some advice. Don't come down the stairs. Call out a carefree goodbye, get in your car and go. Or if you must come down, decline the fruit drink. Stay only long enough to say your farewells. I'll explain later. Until then, I remain your obedient son. We're sitting at the kitchen table, attending in silence to the intermittent thumps of my father's footfalls above as he brings in boxes of books and leaves them in the sitting room. Murderers before the deed find small talk a burden. Dry mouth, thready pulse, whirling thoughts. Even Claude is stumped. He and Trudy drink more black coffee. At each mouthful, they put their cups down without a sound. They're not using saucers. There's a clock I haven't noticed before, ticking in thoughtful iambs. Along the street, a delivery van's pop music approaches and recedes with a faint Doppler effect, the cheerless band lifting and dipping a microtone, but staying in tune with itself. There's a message in there for me, just out of reach. The painkillers are coming on, but the gain is mere clarity where numbness would suit me better. They've been through it twice, and everything is in order. The cups, the potion, the thing, something from the bank, the hat and gloves and receipt, the plastic bag. I'm baffled. I should have listened last night. I won't know if the plan is going well or about to unravel.
I could go up and help him, Claude says at last. You know, many hands make...
Okay, okay, wait. My mother can't bear to hear the rest. She and I have much in common. We hear the front door close, and seconds later those same shoes, old-style leather soles, making the sound on the stairs they made last night when he came down with his lover and settled his fate. He whistles tunelessly as he comes, more Schoenberg than Schubert, a projection of ease rather than the thing itself. Nervous then, despite the lordly speech. No easy matter to evict your brother and the woman you hate who bears your child from the house you love. He's nearer now. Again, my ear is stuck to the gluey wall. There's no inflection or pause or swallowed word I'd care to miss. My informal family dispenses with greetings.
I was hoping to see your suitcase by the door.
He says it humorously, and, as usual, ignores his brother. Not a chance, my mother smoothly says. Sit down and have a coffee. He sits. A pouring sound. A teaspoon clinks. Then my father.
A contractor's coming to remove the appalling mess that's in the hall.
It's not a mess. It's a statement.
Of what?
Protest.
Oh, yes.
At your neglect. Of me. And our baby.
This could be in the noble cause of realism, of the plausible. An oily welcome might raise his guard, and recalling him to his paternal duty. Brava.
They'll be here at 12. Pest control are coming too. They'll be fumigating the place.
Not while we're here, they won't.
That's up to you. They start at midday.
They'll have to wait a month or two.
I've paid them double to ignore you. And they have a key.
Oh,
says Trudy, with an appearance of true regret.
I'm sorry you've wasted so much money.
A poet's money at that. Claude leaps in too soon for Trudy.
I've made this delicious...
Dearest, everyone needs more coffee.
The man who obliterates my mother between the sheets obeys like a dog. Sex, I begin to understand, is its own mountain kingdom, secret and intact. In the valley below, we know only rumours. As Claude stoops over the machine on the far side of the room, my mother says pleasantly to her husband,
"While we're on it, I hear your brother was very kind to you. £5,000. Lucky boy. Did you thank him?"
"He'll get it back, if that's what you mean."
"Like the last lot?"
"He'll get that too.
I hate to think of you spending it all on fumigators."
My father laughs in genuine delight. "Trudy,
I can almost remember why I loved you. By the way, you're looking beautiful.
A little unkempt, she says. But thank you. Theatrically, she lowers her voice, as though to exclude Claude.
After you left, we partied.
All night long.
Celebrating your eviction.
You could say that.
We lean forward, she and I, me, feet first, and my impression is that she's put her hand on his. He's closer now to the sweet disorder of her braids, the wide green look, the pink perfect skin perfumed with a scent he bought her long ago in the Dubrovnik duty-free. How she thinks ahead.
We had a glass or two, and we talked.
We decided. You're right. Time to go our separate ways.
Claude's place is nice, and St. John's Wood is a dump compared to Primrose Hill. I'm so happy about your new friend, Threnody.
Elodie. She's lovely. We had a terrible fight when we got in last night.
But you looked so happy together.
I note the lift in my mother's tone.
She's decided that I'm still in love with you.
This too has an effect on Trudy.
But you said it yourself. We hate each other.
Quite. She thinks I protest too much.
John, should I phone her? Tell her how much I loathe you? His laugh sounds uncertain.
No, there's the path to perdition.
I'm recalled to my mission. The sacred, imagined duty of the child of separated parents is to unite them. Perdition. A poet's word. Lost and damned. I'm a fool to let my hopes rise a point or two, like a futures market after a rout and before the next. My parents are merely playing, tickling each other's parts. Elodie is mistaken. What stands between the married pair is no more than protective irony. Here's Claude bearing a tray, something heavy or sulky in his offer.
More coffee?
God, no, my father says, in the simple, dismissive tone he reserves for his brother.
We've also got some nice...
Darling, I'll have another cup.
A big one.
Your bro, my mother says to my uncle, is in the doghouse with Threnody.
A Threnody, my father defines for her with exaggerated care, is a song for the dead.
Like Candle in the Wind,
says Claude, coming to life.
For God's sake.
Anyway,
Trudy says, retreating some steps back through their exchange, this is the marital home. I'll move out when I'm ready, and it won't be this week.
Come on. You know the fumigator was just a tease. You can't deny it. The place is a shithole.
Press me too hard, John, and I might decide to stay. See you in court.
Point taken. But you won't mind if we remove the crap in the hall.
I do mind a bit.
Then, after a moment's contemplation, she nods her assent. I hear Claude pick up the plastic bag. His cheeriness wouldn't convince the dimmest child.
If you'll excuse me, stuff to do. No rest for the wicked.
10. There was a time when Claude's exit line might have made me smile, but lately, don't ask why, I've no taste for comedy, no inclination to exercise, even if I had the space, no delight in fire or earth, in words that once revealed a golden world of majestical stars, the beauty of poetic apprehension, the infinite joy of reason. These admirable radio talks and bulletins, the excellent podcasts that move me, seem at best hot air, at worst a vaporous stench. The brave polity I'm soon to join, the noble congregation of humanity, its customs, gods and angels, its fiery ideas and brilliant ferment, no longer thrill me. A weight bears down heavily on the canopy that wraps my little frame. There's hardly enough of me to form one small animal, still less to express a man. My disposition is to stillborn sterility, then to dust. These lowering, high-flown thoughts, which I long to declaim alone somewhere, return to oppress me as Claude disappears up the stairs and my parents sit in silence. We hear the front door open and close. I strain without success for the sound of Claude opening the door of his brother's car. Trudy leans forward again, and John takes her hand. The faintest rise in our blood pressure suggests the squeeze of his psoriatic fingers against her palm. She says his name quietly, with a falling tone of fond reproach. He says nothing, but my best guess is he's shaking his head, compressing his lips into a thin smile as if to say, "Well, well, look what's come of us." She says warmly,
"You were right. It's the end. But we can do this gently."
"Yes, it's best," my father agrees in his pleasant, rumbling voice. "But, Trudy, just for old times, shall I say a poem for you?" Her emphatic, childlike shake of the head gently rocks me on my bearings, but I know as well as she does that, for John Cairncross, in poetry, no means yes.
"Please, John, for heaven's sake, don't."
But he's already drawing breath. I've heard this one, but it meant less then.
"Since there's no help, come, let us kiss and part."
Unnecessary, I think, for him to be speaking certain phrases with such relish. "You get no more of me, so cleanly I myself can free, not one jot of former love retain." And at the end, when passion is on his deathbed, and there's a chance against the odds he might recover if only Trudy wished it, my father denies it all with a clever, sarcastic lilt. But she doesn't wish it either, and talks over the last few words.
"I don't want to hear another poem for the rest of my life."
"You won't," my father says affably. "Not with Claude." In this sensible exchange between the parties, no provision is made for me. Another man's suspicions would be stirred by his ex-wife's failure to negotiate the monthly payments that must be due to the mother of his child. Another woman, if she didn't have schemes in hand, would surely demand it. But I'm old enough to take responsibility for myself, and try to be the master of my fate. Like the miser's cat, I retain a secret scrap of sustenance, my one morsel of agency. I've used it in the small hours to inflict insomnia and summon a radio talk. Two sharp, well-spaced blows against the wall, using my heel rather than my near boneless toes. I feel it as a lonely pulse of longing, just to hear myself referred to.
"Ah!"
my mother sighs.
"He's kicking."
"Then I should be going," my father murmurs. "Shall we say 2 weeks for you to clear out?"
I wave to him, as it were, and what do I get? Then, therefore, in which case, and so,
he's going.
2 months. But hang on a minute till Claude gets back. Only if he's quick. An airplane a few thousand feet above our heads makes an airy downward glissando towards Heathrow. A threatening sound, I always think. John Cairncross may be considering one last poem. He could wheel out, as he used to before journeys, a valediction forbidding mourning. Those soothing tetrameters, that mature, comforting tone, would make me nostalgic for the sad old days of his visits. But instead, he drums his fingers on the table, clears his throat, and simply waits. Trudy says,
"We had smoothies this morning from Judd Street, but I don't think we left you any."
With these words, the affair begins at last. A toneless voice that comes as though from the wings of a theatre in a doomed production of a terrible play says from the head of the stairs,
"No, I put aside a cup for him. He was the one who told us about that place, remember?"
He descends as he speaks. Hard to believe that this too well-timed entrance, these clumsy, improbable lines, were rehearsed in the small hours by drunks. The styrofoam container with its plastic lid and straw is in the fridge,
which opens and closes now. Claude sets it down before my father with a breathy maternal.
There.
Thanks, but I'm not sure I can face it. An early mistake. Why let the contemptible brother, rather than the sensuous wife, bring the man his drink? They'll need to keep him talking, and then let's hope he'll change his mind.
Let's?
This is how it is, how stories work when we know of murders from their inception. We can't help siding with the perpetrators in their schemes. We wave from the quayside as their little ship of bad intent departs.
Bon voyage.
It's not easy. It's an achievement to kill someone and go free. The datum of success is the perfect murder. And perfection is hardly human. On board, things will go wrong. Someone will trip on an uncoiled rope. The vessel will drift too far west of south. Hard work, and all at sea. Claude takes a seat at the table, draws a busy breath, plays his best card. Small talk, or what he considers small talk to be.
These migrants, eh? What a business. And don't they envy us from Calais? The jungle. Thank God for the English Channel.
My father can't resist. Ah, England, bound in with the triumphant sea, whose rocky shore beats back the envious siege. These words raise his mood. I think I hear him draw the cup towards him. Then he says,
"But I say, invite them all in. Come on, an Afghan restaurant in St. John's Wood."
"And a mosque," says Claude, "or three, and wife beaters and girl abusers by the thousand."
Did I ever tell you about the Goashad Mosque in Iran? I saw it once at dawn. Stood there amazed. In tears. You can't imagine the colours, Claude. Cobalt, turquoise, aubergine, saffron, the palest green, crystal white, and everything in between.
I've never heard him call his brother by his name. A strange elation has seized my father. Showing off to my mother, letting her know by comparison what she'll be missing. Or freeing himself from the clammy musings of his brother, who now says, in a tone of cautious compromise,
"Never considered Iran. But Sharm el-Sheikh, the Plaza Hotel, lovely. All the trimmings. Almost too hot for the beach."
"I'm with John," my mother says. "Syrians, Eritreans, Iraqis, even Macedonians. We need their youth. And, darling, will you bring me a glass of water?" Claude is instantly at the kitchen sink. From there he says,
"Need? I don't need to be hacked to pieces in the street, like Woolwich."
He comes back to the table with two glasses. One is for himself. I think I see where this is heading. He continues,
"Haven't been down the tube since 7-7.
In the voice he uses to talk past Claude, my father says, "I saw it calculated once. If sex between the races goes on as now, in 5,000 years, everyone on Earth will be the same pale coffee colour." "I'll drink to that," my mother says.
"I'm not against it, really," Claude says. "So cheers."
"To the end of race," my father agreeably proposes. But I don't think he's raised his cup. Instead, he turns to the matters in hand. "If you don't mind, I'll pop round with Elodie on Friday. She wants to measure up for curtains." I picture a hayloft, off which 100-kilo sack of grain is tossed to the granary floor, then another, and a third. Such are the thuds of my mother's heart.
"That's fine, of course," she says in a reasonable voice. "We could give you lunch."
"Thanks, but we've a crowded day. And now I should be going. The traffic's heavy."